from a much-loved LP, Romantic Russia. That was the Ruslan and Lyudmila Overture by Glinka. The London Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Sir George Scholte. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you've enjoyed the music, and thank you so much for listening. Next week, James is back with his own custom-built selection. I'll be listening at home while raiding my own shelves for my next appointment with you, which will be in 2 weeks' time. In the meantime, enjoy your listening, and do join James next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock, here on Radio 3. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this week by Neil Miners.
Pioneering artist Laurie Anderson traces the roots of possibly one of the most daring and popular of all contemporary art forms.
Now, sometimes people use the term performance art when they don't know what else to call it, or when it's just so outrageous that it's not in any category at all. So we're going to try to get close to what this art form is. A retrospective of the work of Marina Abramović was presented in 2010 at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. In one part of the show, called The Artist is Present, she sat motionless for 3 months.
Living and Present, Laurie Anderson on Performance Art is the Sunday feature. Tonight at 7:45 on BBC Radio 3.
And you're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's midday and time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest this week is the philosopher Angie Hobbs.
Angie Hobbs is no ordinary philosopher. Her job takes her to places as varied as cathedrals, air force bases and merchant banks, as well as frequently to our radios and television screens. As our first ever professor of the public understanding of philosophy, based at Sheffield University, she's determined to ensure that philosophy doesn't remain exclusively in the hands of academics. She wants it to inspire us all to explore the big questions in our lives. So, Angie, what do you say to merchant bankers?
Well, I have discussions about the ethics of money and banking and what money is good for and what it's bad for.
Where did you get this desire to sort of to practice more widely, if you see what I mean?
I was inspired by the ancient Greek philosophers who I studied originally. So I trained as a classicist. And in the ancient Greek world, there was a very strong belief that philosophy should help people to reflect on their lives and to work towards transforming their lives and also to help the community. So I never grew up with the idea that philosophy should be in an ivory tower. I grew up with models like Socrates in the market square and Plato in the Academy, Aristotle in the Lyceum, all working really hard to bring philosophy into the heart of people's lives.
So there's quite a direct correlation there with music, which those of us that practice music feel much the same about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel passionately that philosophy can help make people's lives more interesting and more fun. And the primary motivation is to say there is all this exciting, wonderful stuff out there. There are ideas, there are arguments there that you may not have come across before. Why would you not want to discover all these riches? Here are the doors. Let me invite you to walk through them.
In your childhood, what were the things that enthused you? I mean, and was music one of them?
Oh, yes. No, my parents were both absolutely passionate about music, all forms of music, perhaps particularly classical music. I do remember Radio 3. In fact, when I was very small, it would have been the third programme, being on all the time, and both my parents conducting away to pieces on it and introducing me to pieces and, you know, choosing pieces for me to listen to. But also I remember my father singing to me. So one of my earliest memories, he would get back from work at about just after 7 and I'd be in bed, but I was allowed to stay awake until he'd come up and sung to me. And he would sing English, Irish, Scottish-American folk songs and ballads and songs from the musicals. I seem to remember Marlene Dietrich featuring very strongly. And that's just a lovely memory.
And was this first piece introduced to you at that period?
Oh, yes. So my father's favourite composer was Beethoven. And I remember him saying to me more than once that he felt that Beethoven was the greatest composer and that the Seventh was his greatest symphony and this was his favourite movement in it. And I can absolutely see him sitting in his chair, listening to this movement, conducting away, something like a gin in it on his right side, whatever volume of Proust he was currently reading on his left, because though he read other things, he always was reading Proust. And this piece to me just sums up my father, and it is now also my favourite piece of music.
What are the qualities in it that you particularly love?
It's so inspirational. The way it seems to grow and hope seems to grow. And I cannot imagine hearing anything more beautiful than this. Oh, it's very hard to hear that without a tear in the eye, I think. That is, it's just the way all the instruments, sort of more and more instruments come in and it grows and this feeling of elation and then that peace at the end.
And it has a kind of pulsing to it as well.
Yes, that sort of has a rhythmic thrusting momentum forward, yes. Oh.
The second movement, Allegretto from Beethoven, Symphony No. 7 in A major, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. So, Angie Hobbs, your childhood was quite a happy one.
Yes, I mean, there was light and shade, as there is in everybody's life. But yes, in many ways, it was idyllically happy. I grew up in the countryside at the foot of Leith Hill in the Surrey Hills. And I remember sort of biking through the Surrey Hills as a child. And it was a very outdoors childhood. And yes, full of laughter, full of friends, full of music.
And Vaughan Williams had a house nearby.
Well, Vaughan Williams had grown up in Leith Hill Place, just up the road, and he still visited it quite often as an adult. And I have always loved his music, and yes, I think...
Which piece do you particularly home in on?
Well, the piece we're about to hear, the Fantasia on a Theme by Thomas Tallis, because I love Tallis too, and for me, this piece perfectly evokes skimming through lanes on my bicycle, lanes foaming with cow parsley on a pristine May or June morning. Just perfect happiness.
This was actually first played in Gloucester Cathedral. And it's interesting because Vaughan Williams had the solo players spread around geographically the church, so that he got a kind of stereophonic effect.
Mm, mm.
And I think in this piece there is a wonderful coming together of an ancient world, or a much older world,
yes.
and the time of Vaughan Williams and the contemporaries, the love of the countryside, the love of folk song,
mm.
And mixed in with this Thomas Tallis's theme.
Thank you.
dappled sunlight, bluebell woods, a sense of freedom. I really like the fact that this piece was introduced to me by my great childhood friend Kate Robinson, who lived two fields away. And she and I used to go biking together for the day with a picnic and so on. So this piece really does evoke very happy childhood days.
Music from Vaughan Williams is Fantasia on a Theme by Thomas Tallis, played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. There was actually in that music for me, as well as something that is sort of gloriously elevated, but there was also a touch of melancholy.
Mm.
And in fact, in your childhood, there was too, presumably, because your older sister was severely disabled.
Yes, Diana was very profoundly disabled with cerebral palsy, both mentally and physically. She died when she was just 15 on Good Friday in 1973 when I was 11. I was still a Christian in those days, and I remember thinking that the Good Friday date was very significant. And she had a very challenging life, but she could smile, she could enjoy things, even though she couldn't move at all and she couldn't talk, and her understanding was very, very limited. But she did love classical music.
Do you think that your going into philosophy might have been slightly prompted by this relatively childhood experience? Because, after all, must make one wonder about the meaning of our existence.
Well, that's very interesting. I hadn't thought of that before. But certainly from my earliest days, I remember being told by my parents that she was very disabled and that she could die at any time. So even before I really understood what death meant, I knew I had a sister who could die at any moment. She was only meant to live a couple of days. It was amazing she lived till she was 15, and that was a tribute to the great care and devotion my parents gave her.
But to have that hanging over you at that age, that's quite an emotional, almost traumatic thing.
Oh, definitely. And I can remember the day of her death so, so vividly. I can remember being told not to go in and kiss her good morning because she had a bit of a cold. And I can remember going and listening outside her door, and I could hear her breathing, which was very laboured. And even though I was only 11, I somehow knew that she was dying. And to my great shame, I remember I didn't want to be in the house when she died. And I remember I took our new puppy for a walk. And when I was up by a particular pond, I remember having this feeling, she's just died. And when I got back, that had just happened. So, though it was not particularly discussed with me, because this was the early 70s and that you didn't do things like that with children then, I'm sure it must have had an effect about... It certainly made me very aware of our mortality and how very short life is and how very important it is to live life to the absolute full. My darling sister wasn't given many... She didn't really have many opportunities to live life to the full, though my parents did surround her with beautiful things and music and did their very, very best for her.
So would this be one of the pieces that she might have...
Yes. I remember my mother saying she seems to particularly love Mozart and Bach, and I think it must be something about the symmetries of their compositions that she must have found reassuring and soothing. She would certainly have listened to this cello suite, not this performance, because this was after her time, but there is no question, I'm sure, that she would have listened to the cello suite number one. Thank you.
It's a wonderful performance, and it is extraordinary music, and in a way fits with what we've been talking about, because the unaccompanied Bach suites for violin and cello are often thought, rather like late Beethoven quartets, to be a sort of mirror to the soul, because there's no hiding place.
Yes, and that there's a purity and a simplicity and a directness.
And that's why you like that particular performance.
Oh, yes. I mean, that absolutely, as you say, it just speaks directly to...
Because you listened to some others, soul. Didn't you, just to see
I
which
did.
One you liked?
I did. Well, I just had a shoulder operation when I was asked to come on this programme, so I had plenty of time to listen to other recordings, and I enjoyed all of them, but this is the one that really resonates with me.
The prelude from Bach's Unaccompanied Cello Suite No. 1, performed by Yo-Yo Ma. Do you often turn to music for catharsis?
Yes, no, I mean almost always, for both joy but also for comfort and solace.
Why do you think, here's a question for a philosopher, why do you think that when we're feeling unhappy, we actually like to listen to something that in one sense makes us more unhappy?
Well, if you go along with Aristotle's theory and his poetics and his theory of catharsis or purging, that through experiencing these emotions, particularly at second hand, we feel the emotions, but to a limited and controlled extent.
From a safe distance.
From a safe distance, and that enables us to purge ourselves of certain griefs and worries. Why do we turn to music? I think it's because it can also make you feel less alone. You can feel, the person who created this, they've been somewhere, if not the same place as me, they've been somewhere pretty similar. And yet, they survived it and composed this piece. And this Emmylou Harris song also gives me that sense of strength and the feeling that one can go on. In one of the bleakest periods of my life, when for a while I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel, I played this song again and again.
Sunburned heart, it burned my eyes. Burned so hot, I thought I'd died. Thought I'd died and gone to hell. Looking for the water from a deeper well. I went to the river, but the river was dry. I fell to my knees and I looked to the sky. Looked to the sky and the spring rain fell. I saw the water from a deeper well. Well, looking for the water from a deeper well. Well, looking for the water from a deeper well. For the blood and ready for the honey, ready for the winning, ready for the bill, looking for the water from a deeper well. I found some love and I found some money, found that blood would drip from the honey, found I had a thirst that I could not quell, looking for the water from a deeper well. Well, looking for the water from a deeper well. Well, looking for the water from a deeper well. Well, I did it for kicks and I did it for hate. I did it for lust and I did it for faith. Did it for need and I did it for love. Addiction stayed on tight like a glove. So I ran with the moon and I ran with the night and the three. outside. People to the bottle, to the gun, to the cell, to the bottom of a hole, of a deeper well. Took my trouble down a dead end trail, reaching out a hand for a holier grail. Hey there, mama, did you carry that load? Did you tell your baby about the bend in the road, about the rebel yell, about the one that fell, looking for the water from a deeper well?
Reaching out a hand for a holier grail, terrific stuff. And there's that forward dynamic, which I think gives one a sense of hope, despite the lyrics. For some reason, I end this song with a feeling of hope.
Deeper Well by Emmylou Harris from the 1995 album Wrecking Ball. Something quite ungratifying deliberately about the accompaniment. There's that drumming, isn't there, which is sort of disturbing. And it's a deliberately unsympathetic accompaniment in some ways, which makes it darker, I think.
Yes, yes. But I like its courage. I think musicians and poets are pretty tough because they do confront the deepest, darkest emotions, and they do come through the other side.
Notoriously, philosophers have been either mad about music or really rather uninterested, haven't they? If one thinks of the famous ones.
Or, in many cases, very conflicted about music. So Plato, my favourite philosopher, enormously conflicted. In the Republic, only certain modes are allowed. I think he responded to music so passionately that he was deeply disturbed about music's capacity to corrupt his ideal citizens.
That there's a quite a sort of cultural history of fear of music bringing on indulgence.
Yes, but
temptation.
But also an understanding of how it could perhaps potentially be harnessed to create interior harmony, and both in the individual psyche and in the state. I mean, Plato does also, in the Republic, as well as censoring some modes, says a very beautiful passage when he says that in the ideal state we must make sure that our young citizens are surrounded by beauty, including beautiful rhythms and melodies, from the moment of birth, so that rhythm and harmony penetrate deeply into the psyche and take a hold on it, and that the different parts of the psyche grow up in harmony. And when he gives his definition of justice in Book 4 of the Republic, justice is not defined in terms of external actions like helping your friends or harming your enemies or giving each person their due or all the previous ways that Greeks had tried to talk about justice. Justice is said to be the internal harmony of the psyche of the agent. And Plato uses musical language for one of the most important passages in the whole of his corpus, and he says the different parts of the psyche must be brought together in harmony like notes on a scale.
You read Greek and Latin for pleasure, Angie Hobbs.
I do.
Your next choice is in Latin.
It is definitely time for some Latin. Yes, as I said, I trained as a classicist, and both Latin and Greek are very important to me, and I love hearing both languages. It's quite difficult to hear ancient Greek sung. There are some snippets you can hear on the web, but happily it's much easier to hear Latin sung, certainly in its medieval and Renaissance forms. So yes, we have a fantastic medieval carol. I think it was initially 14th century, though I believe the words we have are from the late 16th century. And I like to think of our forebears rolling out of the taverns and into midnight mass and absolutely belting this one out. That also reminds me of my brother Mike, who, unlike me, has a very good, strong voice, and he loves to belt out a carol, and like me, he also loves Latin. So not only can music help you feel connected to other humans on the planet in the present, it can also help you feel connected to the past. And I love that sense of continuity and tradition, not tradition in an embalmed or ossified way, but as you say, an evolving, adapting tradition. I find that very moving.
Personant Hodie, sung by the choir of King's College, Cambridge, directed by David Wilcox. All details of the music on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You mentioned earlier, Angie Hobbs, that at that point when your sister was very ill, that you had some kind of religion. Are you religious now, then?
No. I'm an agnostic, I would say, rather than an atheist. I am very interested in religion. I find sort of debates which try to make a great divide between faith and science or faith and philosophy rather arid. Just as a basic fact, if you look at the great philosophers in history, I would have thought at least half have been profoundly religious, and some have been atheists and some have been agnostics. So
then perhaps for you, Tom Waits is a god?
No, I'm not a god, no. But I do love Tom Waits, particularly his album Closing Time, and particularly the track we're about to hear, Virginia Avenue, which has very especial romantic associations for me.
nobody to tell my troubles to. Harold's Club is closing and everybody's going on home. What's a poor boy to do? I just get on back into my short, make it back to the fort, sleep off all the crazy.
Plato would be horrified. If that music doesn't make one feel amorously inclined, I don't know what would. No, I mean, for me, perfect late-night music, particularly if you're not alone in your bath.
Would Plato have found it too manic?
I think he would have just found it too overtly erotic. It is so languorous, so...
Virginia Avenue by Tom Waits from the 1973 album Closing Time. You talked earlier, Angie Hobbs, about your father's influence on your musical tastes. Tell us a little bit about your mother and whether she had any influence.
Oh, absolutely. Mum was an amazing woman, didn't have the opportunity of a university education or career, but was a very bright, competent woman of awe-inspiring organisational powers. And in another age, she would have been CEO of a major company. And she also loved music, many forms of it. And she was very willing to experiment with later 20th century classical music.
Always music to my ears.
And indeed. Well, absolutely. And she used to send me CDs of new discoveries, some of which I still have, still listening to now, which is a lovely way to get to know somebody through their musical tastes. And in fact, in the 1980s, she used to do some unpaid work for Radio 3 on a listener's panel. She would get a selection of programmes each week, and she could choose about four programmes to listen to, and she wrote reports on them. And through this, she was introduced to all sorts of composers who are now famous but were then relatively new and making their name, including the person we're about to hear, Arvo Pärt. Yes.
Well, he has become extremely popular. And the interesting thing about him, since we've been talking about connections to the past and the value of them, Pärt was somebody who was an extreme modernist at one point, and then he threw it all over and went back to the simplicity of old music and medieval music.
Yes.
And he found, and this is really rather remarkable, because most people, when they try and reinvent themselves, you try and jump on a bandwagon, or it's very hard to find a new voice, as it were, a second skin. But he did it totally successfully. This piece, Fratres, which actually survives in all kinds of versions, but this is the piece you've chosen, isn't it? The one
yes,
for strings and percussion.
I particularly like the strings and percussion one, yes.
Thank you.
It's an extraordinary piece. It's both serene and disturbing at the same time. It seems to say to me that death is coming, but if we can accept that fact with equanimity, then we can get on with the purpose of living.
And the percussion adds a kind of ritualistic feel to it.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's a very good piece to meditate on in your bath. If you're alone in your bath, then Pat. If not, then Tom Waits.
Well, if you're not alone in your bath, Tom Waits. You might meditate on other things.
Yes, the Tom Waits, yes.
Arvo Pärt's Fratres for strings and percussion, performed by the Hungarian State Opera Orchestra, conducted by Tomasz Benedek. You were told you were sort of tone deaf, weren't you, by a music teacher, which is probably why you didn't take up an instrument straight away.
No, I wasn't encouraged to take up an instrument. I was told I was tone deaf at school. I was told that I was such a terrible singer that they would rather I just mouthed in assembly and at concerts and didn't actually make any noises. And once in a recorder class, I remember sellotape being put over my lips, which I'm sure would now be in contravention of all sorts of things. So no, I was given no musical confidence at all. I now discover that I'm not remotely tone deaf.
And the harp has become very important.
The harp has, yes. My daughter, who's 13, plays the harp. And one of the loveliest moments in my day is coming back from work and listening to her practice while I prepare supper or whatever I'm doing. And it is the most beautiful instrument and much more versatile than is sometimes recognised. It can take on all sorts of different musical styles. Yes, so if ever I'm less busy than I am at the moment, I have a bit more free time, I would love to learn an instrument and I would love to learn the harp.
And your daughter could help you?
Possibly. She's taught me to do Frère Jacques with one finger, I mean, which I'm very inordinately proud of. Her fingers run up and down and all sorts of
fabulous
things.
Well, we're going to leave with something which is a little more advanced than Frère Jacques.
Mm.
It's the Rodrigo Concierto de Aranjuez, a very famous piece, which I imagine she loves and you love.
What we're going to hear is not the original piece composed for guitar. He arranged it for harp in, I think, 1973. A friend of his asked him to do this. And not so many people know the harp version.
Yes, that'll be interesting.
But I think it's very, very lovely. And we're going to hear the slow movement, which is really poignant.
Well, thank you very much, Angie Hobbs. So let's now hear this rather unusual version of the Rodrigo guitar concerto, the Concierto de Aranjuez, played on the harp by Marisa Robles with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit. Thank you.
Second movement, or part of it, from Rodrigo's Concierto de Aranjuez, arranged for the harp by the composer and performed by Marisa Robles and the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit. That was the final choice of today's guest on Private Passions, Professor Angie Hobbs. Private Passions was presented by Michael Barclay, and it was produced today by Jane Greenwood. It's a Loftus production for Radio 3. Well, if you'd like to hear that programme again, you can download it if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest will be the film critic Philip French. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly. I'm here to guide you through our programmes on Radio 3 this afternoon, which continue in just a moment with the music of a man who led a colourful life, to say the least, the Renaissance composer Carlo Gesualdo. He produced a great quantity of rather remarkable music during his lifetime, but it was a life dogged with troubles. He was accused of a double murder, of witchcraft, and masochism, amongst other things. He was actually a prince, the Prince of Venosa, and led, it seems, a somewhat isolated life. I wonder why. Find out for sure in the Early Music Show in a couple of minutes' time here on Radio 3. That's after a look at the BBC News this lunchtime. The head of the Unite Union, Len McCluskey, says he's delighted the organisation was cleared of any wrongdoing in the selection of a Labour candidate in the constituency of Falkirk. Labour began an investigation after claims the union had tried to rig the process. The row prompted the Labour leader, Ed Miliband, to propose changes to his party's relationship with the unions by giving union members a choice of whether to pay money to Labour rather than fees being automatically transferred. Mr Miliband insists he'll press ahead with the reforms. A prominent Liberal Democrat MP says she'll stand down at the next election because she's dismayed by some of the policies Nick Clegg has backed in government. Sarah Tether singled out her party's approach to immigration and welfare for criticism. The Liberal Democrats said they were disappointed with her decision. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has said the government is not gung-ho about military action, but that the world needs to respond to the use of chemical weapons in Syria. Mr. Hague said there were no plans to ask Parliament to vote again on the matter, but added that if circumstances changed dramatically, everyone would look at things differently. Officials in Afghanistan say a NATO airstrike in the east of the country has killed 15 people, including 9 civilians. NATO said 10 militants died in the strike, but it had no reports of any civilian deaths. The government has insisted that money is being pumped into hospital and emergency departments in England after a BBC survey found evidence of staff shortages. Labour has called on ministers to get a grip urgently on the situation. The International Olympic Committee, having chosen Tokyo as the host of the 2020 Games, will decide today which new sports will be admitted to the event. Under consideration are wrestling, squash, and a joint bid from baseball and softball. And the weather, there'll be scattered showers in western parts this afternoon. Some of them will be heavy and thundery. It'll be mostly dry and sunny in eastern areas, but it will cloud over later this afternoon. Well, that's the BBC News at 1:03. Verez and Berio feature in our Sunday concert in an hour from now. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra will be conducted by Ilan Volkov in 2 20th century masterworks in that concert, which they gave at the Usher Hall in Edinburgh as part of this year's International Festival. Hear what they are at 2:00. And I'll be featuring that, following that rather, with a rather wonderful recording which has recently been released as part of a mammoth boxed set of the pianist Leon Fleischer. His classic 1961 recording with the Cleveland Orchestra under George Sell playing Beethoven's 5th Piano Concerto, The Emperor. It's a remarkable recording, really quite something if you've never heard it. A dream team, really, in that Sell, being undoubtedly one of the greatest conductors of the 20th century, found in Fleischer a perfect collaborator. So if you can be here for that at around 3:15, I promise you it'll be well worth it. Next this afternoon, though, a programme that's certainly worth listening to. It's the Early Music Show, and it's presented today by Catherine Bott.
Hello. Over the last 10 years on the Early Music Show, we've featured a lot of composers about whose long-ago lives very little is known. But some musicians are well-documented, and others have a sort of infamy thrust upon them. Take the subject of today's programme, who died exactly 400 years ago on the 8th of September, 1613. Carlo Gesualdo seems to be remembered more for his depravity than his music. Mind you, the tortured harmonies of some of his madrigals really fuel the myth. I die languishing of grief, Moro Lasso, from Gesualdo's sixth book of madrigals, performed by Il Complesso Barocco, directed by Alan Curtis. This is music that reaches out and grips your vitals, and it would work very well as the soundtrack to one of those historical dramas that are keeping people glued to their televisions at the moment. We've had the Tudors and the Last of the Plantagenets. How about the Gesualdos? To learn more about the skilled, dedicated musician behind the Gesualdo myth, today I'm delighted to be talking down the line to Glenn Watkins, who is Earl V. Moore Professor Emeritus of Music History and Musicology at the University of Michigan in the United States. His recent book, The Gesualdo Hex, is an eloquent corrective to the sensationalist school of research. Let's get this out of the way right at the start. This question of the bloody murder of Gesualdo's wife and her lover in their bed. What is the myth? What did he do?
Well, the murder is not a myth. He actually did commit the murder. The question is that he was not some sort of madman, but rather the opposite. There was a social code at the time that virtually demanded that any person of his station, and he was a prince, after all, and one of the wealthiest men in all of Campania, it was virtually required of him, once adultery was spotted and known, that he was obliged to murder his wife and the lover. He was not the only one. Somehow or other, the view comes across as though this was not what one would normally run across. But one doesn't have to read very far, and one can come with a list of about, maybe five or six.